We'll begin in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. For the 30th of June, 2006, this is the Rain Report, available as a downloadable MP3 file from both arnewsline.org and therainreport.com. I'm Neil Schaefer, AA9KK. The letters SOS were the first many of us learned in Morse code. Today, these letters are part of the national SOS program. Its founder is Eric Knight, KB1EHE.
National SOS Radio Network is an informal group nationwide of people, hams, GMRS operators, scanner operators, and the general public working together to build a local neighborhood-based communication system in case of emergencies. I was, like many of us, monitoring the media coverage of Hurricane Katrina. It was just unless someone was capable of climbing into their attic and cutting a hole in their roof with an axe so that they could wave something for help, it seemed many people were just cut off and stranded within their own house, cut off from their neighbors and family, and many people died right in their own home because they were unable to let anyone know that they were actually there. Okay, well, how can people who are, you know, once cell service stopped, telephone service stopped, once all the primary methods of calling, you know, 911 and all those primary methods fail because of a catastrophe like that, how can someone call for help? And it just, the idea came to me of these FRS radios. They're ubiquitous. There's 100 million of them, and we've read statistics that they're being sold at 12.2 million a year. So many people have these radios. And the thought, again, just was very, very simple. What if people had these radios that were able to then at least tell their neighbor that they're stuck in their basement or that the floodwaters are coming up or something has happened? And that was really the spark of the idea. We started to discuss this in the local ham clubs here in Connecticut, brainstorming, and people thought it was a good idea. And it started to gel, and we thought that we'd start a little community to talk about it. We created a little website. We got some more interest, and really that was the impetus for the whole thing. It really was seeing these poor, desperate people who, if they only had another simple way to communicate, that would have been a great help. We've had some people have mentioned that this is akin to a signal flare on a sinking ship. You're going down, your radio's out, your boat's going to go under. If you had one other mechanism to at least try and get attention, like a signal flare, you may as well use it. And again, this is something like that, but as a measure of last resort, contacting your neighbor possibly who might also be monitoring this same radio because of the drills and everybody being accustomed to it may be a lifeline to help.
What is different about what you're doing versus the various citizens groups that are now getting involved with local EMAs and municipalities?
I think this is it's a perfect augment to that. Our real focus is really on the community neighborhood level, really house to house in neighborhoods. And we discovered that there are 100 million of these little FRS or FRS radio compatible devices out there in the community. And we thought that would be a great way for people to be able to correspond with each other in a case of emergency within the neighborhood. And what we're just trying to do is to inspire the people who have these radios to be able to use them in case of an emergency.
All you have to do is go to a festival or a major sporting event in an urban area and turn on FRS, and it's a zoo. How do you plan to harness that undisciplined activity?
That's an excellent question. We just recently conducted a drill June 17th to find out for ourselves if this chaotic environment could be harnessed. And we conducted a drill here in Connecticut. It was statewide, encouraging the general public to tune into channel 1 on their FRS radio and to talk with them amongst each other. This drill happened in the afternoon from 1 to 3 o'clock local time here in Connecticut. We also asked the public to tune to Channel 3 to try to correspond with us. We had set up a monitoring station in the Hartford area so we could hear firsthand how well the public could communicate. We knew we were creating almost a potential for an uncontrolled field day, so to speak, but we really wanted to experience it for ourselves, really as a testing environment to see how it would work. Well, we were very, very surprised and pleasantly surprised of the courtesy and the organization of truly untrained public to be able to talk to us directly at the central receiving station in Hartford. People essentially just took their turns, and for 2 hours straight, we had QSOs with the public. Many people had never even used their radios before. It was just inspiring for us to see how kind of human nature and good old-fashioned courtesy took over. The public took this very seriously, and we didn't have any problems communicating with them for the two-hour period. We notified the media that we were going to conduct this drill. We also informed other state agencies, such as the Connecticut Department of Emergency Management and Homeland Security, that we'd be conducting the drill. The media helped us get the word out. I ran some newspaper articles. There were a couple of local TV stories. So the public was aware of this. And again, since we're an all-volunteer group, we didn't have any money to place any marketing or advertising. The success of the drill and the awareness was really contingent on the media announcing this for us. Starting a couple of weeks before the event, we put out some press releases, and the media picked up on it. Again, we notified the appropriate emergency management office here in Connecticut, and they said it was fine for us to conduct the drill. That's how we built the level of grassroots awareness. And then we essentially monitored those couple of frequencies during that time. I think us ham radio operators and GRMS operators, we take for granted how easily and freely we communicate on the air. Radios are kind of second nature tools to us. To hear the public and the excitement and the voices of people, for many for the first times, they've either used these radios when they're talking to their spouses or their kids, but never really outside of their little home network. To be able to correspond with someone miles away was an amazing awareness to people, and to hear the excitement in people's voice was worth it right there, of the directly participate in something like this. The other fringe benefit of this was people experiencing kind of the magic of radio for the first time. We had many people asking us about ham radio, about GMRS radio, and wanting to find out how they can be licensed GMRS users and how they could get their amateur radio license. And that in itself, we feel, a tremendous fringe benefit to this, where many people in the public who are not exposed to radio before may now be interested in amateur radio and want to become ham radio operators or licensed GMRS operators. And I think that is a pleasantly surprising fringe benefit of everything we're doing.
Tell me about FRS, Family Radio Service.
Family Radio Service is a service whereby the general public can use radios that they can buy at a department store, very low cost, and under the FRS regulations, as long as they operate on the certain frequencies that have been set for, keep their power output to 500 milliwatts or less, and also don't try to use external antennas and some other regulations that are part of the FRS regulations that the FCC puts out, there is no license required. Therefore, anyone of any age could purchase a radio, and as long as they adhere to those and other standards, can use these radios without a license. That's differentiated from the GRMS users and licensees. Even though the frequencies are shared in many cases, someone wanting to operate above 500 milliwatts and on other frequencies would then require a license, which is $80 from the FCC. So even though some of the frequencies are shared, they're kind of an overlapping system. There's a differentiation between the requirements of being able to use the system without a license or with a license. And we continually reinforce in our drill and in the contacts we have with the public to make sure that they're using their radio set at the low power level or the 500 milliwatt or less, so that they're not breaking the law.
GMRS is a service that actually uses repeaters. Do I understand that the Family Radio Service is strictly simplex?
That's correct. And it's a very simple service. And that's, so the FCC has created a very narrow niche of requirements that that are able to be used without a license. GMRS users can operate at higher power, can use repeaters. There's a number of other privileges that one would get as a licensee, again, for their $80 license. So there is a very clear delineation, and we continually reinforce that to make sure people adhere strictly to the FCC, the FCC laws. Our focus is essentially the first seven channels of the FRS GMRS spectrum, and particularly the first two or three, channel one and channel three. Channel 1 is at 462.5625, and channel 3 is 462.6125. Those channels are easily tunable by even the most inexpensive FRS radios, and are also easily accessible by GMRS operators, who are also very important in this endeavor.
I'm speaking today with Eric Knight, KP1EHE, the founder of National SOS. We'll be right back. This is the Rain Report.
You're listening to the Rain Report from www.therainreport.com.
Those couple of frequencies we just mentioned, as amongst some others, are shared amongst FRS and GRMS users. Let me give you an idea of how our receiving station was set up. That might help provide some perspective. We set up a receiving station in the Hartford area for our June 17 drill that was comprised of a little handheld GRMS radio. It was a Maxon 210, something that's been around for many years. And we set up outside of an automobile. We had a four-foot antenna attached to this handheld radio and monitoring the couple of FRS frequencies. And I have a GRMS license as well as my ham license. So I was able, because of my GMRS license, be able to freely correspond and legally correspond with the FRS users in the public. So that's really the conduit, is the GMRS license and license holders are very important to this endeavor, as they can, under all circumstances, be able to correspond with FRS users legally.
Eric, what has the reaction been from the ham radio community?
Well, it's been a mixed review so far. The ham radio community has been skeptical for some of the reasons you mentioned, that you know, we have this untrained public, and how could they possibly participate in emergency communication? So I recognize and appreciate that skepticism. And again, the way we look at this is an experiment where we're trying to see if the public could participate in its own emergency communication needs during a time of crisis. It's not a given that this will work out. I think healthy skepticism is warranted. What's nice, though, over the last few weeks, once we've run the test and we started to publish some of the results of the test, we've now had many more ham radio operators contact us being interested to participate. So that makes us feel good that we're maybe starting to turn the corner a little bit. I've been a ham for 32 years. What drives me in amateur radio is community service and public service. So to me, using FRS radio, whether it's GMRS or amateur radio, it's all part of the same type of community service. And I'm hoping that other hams will feel likewise over time, that this is a way to get the public involved in their own assistance in an emergency matter, and could also help inspire new hams and new GMRS operators along the way. So I think it could be a win-win all the way around. But this is really still an experiment, something that we're doing from state to state, trying to see how this will work. Time will tell if we're successful or not, but you don't know unless you try, and that's kind of our philosophy.
What kind of response are you getting from the American Radio Relay League?
We've had a few discussions with the league, and they are taking a wait-and-see attitude. They'd just like the general ham population, they'd like to see how it goes. We've promised to provide them with data, which we are, the results of the experiments. The league is open-minded, and they'd like to see how things go. I think that's kind of an accurate assessment. We'd like to ultimately get the league on board and supportive, but we're happy to take the lead and to see how it works and provide the data so others can make a judgment on it. People have been contacting us and how they can conduct their own drill in their area. So what we're doing is making our equipment that we have here, these radios and antennas, providing them on loan to people if they want to pay for shipping. We're game to box all the equipment and send it to somebody if some state or town would like to conduct a drill. And we're finding we're getting a lot of interest. We call it a drill in the box. Nothing fancy. We have two handheld radios, an antenna, power adapter, coax cable, log sheets, and such. And we're game to box that up for anyone who'd like to pay for shipping. We'll send it out on loan free if somebody would like to conduct the drill. The only prerequisite is, of course, is somebody has to have a bona fide GMRS license, also be a ham licensee. It would be very, very helpful if they also were skilled in contesting, like field day, because the public contests come fast and furious. So it's really good for people who are good contesters to be the operator of the station. If someone was interested, we have an email address, sosdrill@nationalsos.com. Again, that's SOSDRILL, D-R-I-L-L, at nationalsos.com. And we'd be game to ship our equipment to them and so they can conduct their own tests and find out for themselves exactly how this works.
To be a member today of FEMA or EMA, there are various government exams that now need to be passed, IS 100, 200, and 700. What kind of exams do you foresee being worked into your testing criteria?
The way we envision this is augmenting these very well-established systems and protocols. We see that at the very, very local level, the public level, again, household to household, we're just trying to help communications in that area, and we don't see that there has to be a regimented test for one household to be able to talk to another household. I think that would start setting up barriers for people to participate. So again, we want to make the training very simple so we get as many adopters of what we're doing as possible. We're putting out materials on our website that people can download, also wallet cards with little summaries of how to use things that they could put in their wallet or purse, and try to, again, make it very, very simple. Adoption is the key to this, and we were very, very pleased at some of the feedback and encouragement from the Connecticut Department of Emergency Management, Homeland Security. Right before our June 17 drill, the commissioner of that department, James Thomas, said in the Hartford Courant, which is the largest newspaper here in Connecticut, he said that if this is something that will improve communication among family members and neighbors, we're all for it. And again, we just want to augment that, just provide this very local family radio network, neighborhood communications that augments these much more complex and other very important established emergency communication systems. So we're just trying to blend the two together so that there's a seamless integration between the very local communications, communications at a broader level.
What standards are you using for training?
What we're doing is providing the public in our press releases some basic information of how they should communicate, what they should say. Again, these are people who have never used their radio other than for family communication, so giving them some very basics. Then what we're trying to do, we're keeping in our initial drills the goals and requirements very simple so that the public can have a good first impression of using their radio. Essentially, what we're asking them is to turn their radios on, to tune them to either channel 1 or channel 3, depending on the part of the drill they're participating in, and to make sure that their privacy codes or tones are turned off on their radios, and just seeing if they can communicate with their neighbor or down the street or in their community. So very, very simple tasks. And after that, what we're doing is, in some of the program materials we're doing for subsequent drills in those same areas, we're going to ask additional tasks of the public to maybe relay the state of certain situations in an emergency to us. And again, trying to do it in a very simple way. Again, just to get people to come out of their house and turn the radio on and talk is a major accomplishment in our eyes. And we're trying to make sure that in each step along the way, we provide some positive reinforcement and make it a nice progression so that we can train them while they're learning about using radio at the same time as we're teaching them about emergency communications.
To learn more about the National SOS program, go to their website, www.nationalsos.com, nationalsos.com. I've been speaking today with the founder of the National SOS Program, Eric Knight, KB1EHE, of Farmington, Connecticut. For the Rain Report, I'm Hap Holly, KCNRP, in Chicago.
Just a reminder that you can hear the last several weeks of Rain programming on the Rain Archive page on therainreport.com. The Rain Report is copyright 1990-2006 Rain, all rights reserved. I'm Neil Schaefer, AA9KK.